Hello, Saints. It's a bit unusual to see so many people here on a Sunday afternoon, but thank you all for coming. I'll try not to put you to sleep, but there are no promises. There are no promises. Yeah. There's a lot of readings to do. I'm doing the second part of my Joseph Bible study for those of you that are here on Wednesday and live to tell the tale. We're going to hit the rest of it. There's a delicious irony for me having Chris here because my first meeting, Chris gave the talk and he went on and on about all these names in the Old Testament. I mean, seriously, he just went on and on. It was a fascinating talk. I'm sure it was. And yet it's like getting saved after a tithing talk. It's proved that God can save you no matter what's going on in the meeting. You know, one of my other favourite memories or testimonies was a guy I took to a meeting in Melbourne who just hated the whole experience. He railed against it. He would stand up and he would call out during the meeting, and he got filled with the Holy Spirit afterwards too. It's just like you can't pick what's going to happen when God's going to work a work. You know, I went along to this house meeting to try and get Wayne out because, you know, it looked like he'd been caught up by some bunch of no good Christian wannabes. And it was great hearing Chris talk about, you know, he went to get his brother out of trouble, and Lynn talking about, you know, she went to check into what Joan had been doing and how the cult busters got called in. I had a similar experience when I went back to Tasmania for the first time, that there was, you know, senior members of the Uniting Church were there to try and, you know, deprogram me. And it was one of the most great experiences in my life because I knew nothing about the scriptures. I knew absolutely nothing about the scriptures other than, of course, what Chris had taught me through his excellent house meeting tutelage. All I knew was, you know, the real basics of the scriptures and the fact that I could speak in tongues, the fact that I was baptized by full immersion in water, and they had nothing. They had nothing to say about this. And, you know, they asked that the Bible be put away really quickly in the conversation. I'm like, hang on, you're the minister, you're the lead oversight, you're my dad who's, you know, been telling me about the Bible my whole life. Let's bring the Bible back into the conversation and see what happens. And so that's all people have. You know, we have an experience from God. They have whatever it is that they have, and look, they're fervent in their belief. I don't deny that, but they're fervently wrong. And it turns out when you tell your dad that, it doesn't go down that well. But, you know, that's what happened. It's like, if you're going to try and deprogram me, I'm going to try and program you because, you know, I'm a programmer. So it's great how we don't have to be scholars of the Bible because we've had an experience with God. We can speak in tongues and we know God's changed us. You know, that much we all know, despite what people may think by looking at us, we know that God's worked a work in our life. And hearing Chris's testimony, because I've known him for a long time, none of this wild child side of him, it's a bit like Kingsley, when you talk to Kingsley about what he used to do, you know, you would never know it, speaking to Chris, and you know, Rosie obviously keeps him under control and does an excellent job there, but you just never would know what our lives are like, you know, before we come to the Lord, because the change is so complete and so instant in a lot of cases that we just go from being one person to a completely different person, and praise the Lord for that. Because that's what we need. We need to be changed literally in the twinkling of an eye. Not all of us get this amazing revelation straight away of what God's plan and purpose is, but, you know, it comes to us through time that you understand how different we've been made and how blessed we really are. And that's kind of what the story of Joseph is about. It's about, you know, we talked about, you know, bad things happened to Joseph, but it didn't matter wherever he was, God blessed him because he was Joseph. You know, God had this relationship with him that his brothers were jealous of, they didn't understand, but that's what it was. Okay, so we'll try and zip through this, but there is a lot to get through. Chapter 41 of Genesis. So I'm going to summarise a lot of the chapters because there is basically 10 chapters to get through and we don't have nearly enough time for that, and I'm pretty sure I would fall asleep. Okay, but we will do quite a bit of reading here on chapter 41 because this, of course, is the key chapter of it all, really. This is, you know, we know that Joseph not only dreams dreams, but he's able to interpret dreams, and he always gives the credit to God. He says that, you know, God is the one that puts these things here to be interpreted. God is the one that can interpret them. So here we go. Chapter 41 and verse 1. And it came to pass at the end of 2 full years that Pharaoh dreamed, and behold, he stood by the river. And behold, there came up out of the river 7 well-favoured kine, or cows, and fat-fleshed, and they fed in a meadow. Maybe they came from Durinillin or, you know, Moody Arup or something like that. And they fed in a meadow, and behold, 7 other kine came up out after them of the river, ill-favoured and lean-fleshed, and stood by the other kine upon the brink of the river. Perhaps they came from Collie. And the ill-favoured and lean-fleshed kine did eat up the 7 well-favoured and fat kine, so Pharaoh awoke, as you would, because if you're dreaming of this many cattle, what's going on in your life? What did you have for dinner? I don't know. It's a bit weird. Maybe the curry was a bit spicy or something like that. So Pharaoh awoke, and he slept and dreamt the second time, and behold, 7 ears of corn came up upon one stalk, rank and good, and behold, 7 thin ears, and blasted with the east wind, sprung up after them, and the 7 thin ears devoured the 7 rank and full ears, and Pharaoh awoke, and behold, it was a dream. Okay, so he's had this thing, and he doesn't know what it means, but it sounds like some sort of Tim Burton movie, you know, The Nightmare Before Christmas or Corpse Bride or Alice in Wonderland. Anyone with me here? Anyone know Tim Burton? Thank you, Shoshana. For the record, one person acknowledging Tim Burton. Batman, the first Batman, dark, always crazy. Fine. And it came to pass that Andy had to call upon the assembly because he was troubled. No. And it came to pass in the morning that his spirit was troubled, and he sent and called for all the magicians of Egypt and all the wise men thereof. And Pharaoh told them his dream, but there was none that could interpret them unto Pharaoh. And as we recall, with the interpreting of the dreams, that Joseph, while he was in prison, helped out the chief butler, didn't help out the other guy so much because he died, but he said to the chief butler, make sure you remember me to Pharaoh. And this is 2 years later. The chief butler had said nothing, but here it is. Time is up. In verse 9, then spake the chief butler unto Pharaoh, saying, I do remember my faults this day, or in the modern, my bad. Pharaoh was wroth with his servants and put me in ward in the captain of the guard's house, both me and the chief baker. And we dreamed a dream. And then in verse 12, there was with us a young man, a Hebrew servant to the captain of the guard. And we told him, and he interpreted to us our dreams, to each man according to his dream he did interpret. And it came to pass, as he interpreted to us, so it was me he restored unto mine office, and him he hanged. Verse 14, you know, because 50-50 chance. Then Pharaoh sent and called unto Joseph, and they brought him hastily out of the dungeon, and he shaved himself and changed his raiment and came in unto Pharaoh. So, interesting takeaway here. So he's been in jail for all this time. And this is very symbolic, I think, of our work in the Lord, that not, of course, that we need to be clean-shaven, because certain of us, you know, razors bounce off our face and we can't quite just trim ourselves down. But we have to be ready to go to do the Lord's work at a moment's notice. It's not always convenient. You know, he was probably busy running the prison, happy, you know, watching his Netflix, and life was pretty, not good necessarily, but it was well ordered. He had a good position, and then suddenly he's yanked out to see Pharaoh. Now, he knows, because of what happened last time, there's a 50-50 chance of how this is going to go. You know, you're either going to be taken out of prison or you're going to be taken out of prison and killed. So that's a bit risky. So he's shaved, and he's got the nice clothes put on and brought into Pharaoh. In verse 15, and Pharaoh said unto Joseph, I've dreamed a dream, and there is none that can interpret it, and I have heard say of thee that thou canst understand a dream to interpret it. And Joseph again says here, it is not me, God shall give Pharaoh an answer of peace. And Pharaoh said unto Joseph, in my dream, behold, I stood upon the bank of the river, and behold, came up the cattle, and off we go. Dream, dream, dream. We'll go down to verse 24. And the thin ears devoured the 7 good ears, and I told this unto the magicians, but there was none that could declare it unto me. And Joseph said unto Pharaoh, the dream of Pharaoh is one. God has showed Pharaoh what he's about to do. The 7 good kine are 7 years, and the 7 good ears are 7 years. The dream is one. And the 7 thin and ill-favoured kine that came up to them are 7 years, and the 7 empty years blasted with the east wind shall be 7 years of famine. This is the thing which I have spoken unto Pharaoh. What God is about to do, he shows unto Pharaoh. Behold, there shall become 7 years of great plenty throughout all the land of Egypt, and there shall arise after them 7 years of famine, and all the plenty shall be forgotten in the land of Egypt, and the famine shall consume the land. Okay, so we go on to, there's a few more verses describing how bad things are going to be. But in verse 34, let Pharaoh do this and let him appoint officers over the land and take up the fifth part of the land of Egypt in the seven plenteous years. So not only has Joseph, he hasn't come just to solve the problem of the dream, don't bring me problems, bring me solutions. So he brings to Pharaoh a very carefully calculated taxation plan, but it's designed to save the land of Egypt. So in verse 39, and Pharaoh said unto Joseph, for as much as God has showed thee all this, there is none so discreet and wise as thou art. Thou shalt be over my house, and according to thy word shall all my people be ruled. Only in the throne will I be greater than thou. So it's a big day for Joseph, a big day. And I guess at this point he knows he gets the good outcome, not the bad outcome. And in verse 42, and Pharaoh took off his ring from his hand and put it upon Joseph's hand and arrayed him in vestures of fine linen and put a gold chain about his neck. So a lot happening here. In verse 45, and Pharaoh called Joseph's name Zaphnath-Paneah, and gave him a wife, Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, and Joseph went out over all the land of Egypt. And Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, and Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went throughout all the land of Egypt. So that was quite a day for him. Quite a day. So he'd been in prison for quite an amount of time. He was sold into slavery at 17. He spent an amount of time with Potiphar, had the run-in with Potiphar's wife, put into jail. He interprets the dream at 28, made second in command of the prison. So at age 30, here he is, number two guy in Egypt, and he's not even an Egyptian. So if there's any doubt of what the Lord can do in your life, Joseph is here to say, not only can we have the ridiculous happen, but we can have the sublime. Not only can we have little blessings, we can have full-on major, literally take over a country blessings. And that's what happened, because this is what the Lord's will was. Joseph wasn't particularly, I don't think he woke up wishing he was going to be the Prime Minister of Egypt, but it was the Lord's will, and he understood it was the Lord's will. This is what it is I've got to do. The same as it was the Lord's will to have him in a hole and get sold into slavery. He just literally rolled with the Lord's punches. And so we find ourselves from time to time fighting against what we know to be the will of the Lord. That it could be a good thing happening in our life, it could be a bad thing happening in our life, but we know the Lord wants to move us in a certain direction, and we know we want to move in the opposite direction. And so we think, surely if we pray and fast about this thing, the Lord will change his mind. We think, surely if we, perhaps do more for the church, the Lord will change his mind. We think, perhaps if we give up chocolate for Lent, the Lord will change his mind. The Lord won't change his mind. God is omnipotent. God knows what his plan is. He knows what his purpose is. He knows what our purpose is for him. So it's our job as sons and daughters of the living God to do what God says, to follow the will of God. If God says, we should go off and do a certain thing, then we should go off and do a certain thing. And what I absolutely believe, like Joseph absolutely believes, is when God speaks to us, we know it. Sometimes we think we know what God's saying to us because that's what we want to do, but often God will speak to us and we know. It could be in Michelle and Mike's case, coming down to Bunbury, it was clear that it was the will of God, because everything that was impossible was done, and we knew it was impossible because people would tell us that's impossible. You can't sell a house that quickly. You can't get finance from the bank that quickly. You can't buy a house that quickly. Nothing was possible in the eyes of the people we're dealing with, but in the eyes of God, it's where we had to be. I went from a job in Perth, which I thought was going to be the job I retired at, a job that I really, really liked, to suddenly having a job in Bunbury, in a day. That's how quickly these things happen. So I didn't end up being the Prime Minister of Australia, but I'm kind of thinking the current Pentecostal guy that's got that job, he's not getting love so much. So probably best that I'm just here. But that's how quickly God can move in our lives. Joseph understood it. I understood it. I know that you guys understand it. Sometimes, though, we just don't understand it because it's not what we want to hear. But praise the Lord, he reveals it to us and we get the message. And all the people said? Okay, you're still here. Good. So one of the things I did on Wednesday was I was also likening the story of Joseph with the story of Jesus. Well, that keeps going, you know, it's just because we stopped partway through. So in verse 57, we get, "And all countries came into Egypt to Joseph for to buy corn, because of the famine was so sore in all the lands." So obviously, when you know there was the 7 good years, and not many people actually have the discipline, self-discipline, you know, in times of plenty to put things aside for the times that are not plenteous. You know, thinking about Rod talking about interest rates, can anybody who was paying a mortgage at that time think we were ever going to get to 0% interest rates? It just seemed like you didn't even have dreams that were like that. I remember people talking about if it got only down to 10%, that'd be fine, because surely only God charges 10%. You know, what are the banks charging 18% interest for? You know, they were just crazy times. And yet, you know, the global economy, it goes up, it goes down, it goes up. But, you know, the Lord, he's just got a plan, he's got a purpose, and he sticks to it. So here we have all the countries came to Egypt to Joseph to buy corn because the famine was sore. If we go to John chapter 6, we get our parallel. Just one verse here. John chapter 6 and verse 35, "And Jesus said unto them, I am the bread of life. He that comes to me shall never hunger, and he that believes on me shall never thirst." You know, this is the promise that the death, the resurrection of Jesus, the gift of the Holy Spirit gives us everything we will ever need. You know, we won't hunger anymore, we won't thirst anymore, because we've followed God's plan and purpose. Well, in Joseph's time, the plan and purpose was obviously put aside the grain so that when the famine comes, we can feed our people. It did occur to me, though, and I don't, a bit like Pastor Philip, some things occur to us in odd times, and it occurred to me, so there was a 20% allocation to put aside for the store, but that was never going to be enough to feed Egypt. If Egypt were using 80% every year and there was going to be 7 years of famine, well, then they were going to have a problem at some point. Certainly they were going to start off better than all the surrounding people because they had these storehouses of grain, but they were going to run out. And that's exactly what happened. It's just, yeah, I don't know why it never occurred to me, but some things they do. Okay, so back to Genesis 41. Okay, so chapter 41, verse 53. It's also interesting to me how much of Genesis is devoted to the story of Joseph. And I mean, other than the fact that it's a great story, you have to ask yourself, okay, what is in here that God really wants us to learn about? If he's devoted so much of the sort of the primary book of the Bible, what should we be taking out of here? And of course, there's lots that we can take out of here because, you know, right from the very beginning, if we talk about God's plan and purpose, we've got all these parallels between Joseph and Jesus. You know, we've got the setting up of Jacob and his children and the 12 children of Israel, and all of that becomes, all happens in this space. So verse 53, "And the 7 years of plenteousness that were in the land of Egypt were ended, and the 7 years of dearth began to come, according as Joseph had said, and the dearth was in all the lands, but in the land of Egypt there was bread. And when the land of Egypt was famished, the people cried to Pharaoh for bread, and Pharaoh said unto all the Egyptians, Go to Joseph, what he says to you, do." So again, Pharaoh's like, oh man, I'm on a winner here, can do no wrong. I've got the scapegoat. If it all goes wrong, we're blaming the Hebrew, he's not an Egyptian, but if it works, aren't I good for picking the guy who understood how to solve the problem? Nothing but upside politically there. And 56, "And the famine was all over the face of the earth, and Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold unto the Egyptians, and the famine waxed sore in the land of Egypt." Okay. Chapter 42. Now things start to get interesting. Now, when Jacob saw that there was corn in Egypt, Jacob said to his sons, "Why do you look one upon another?" And he said, "Behold, I've heard that there's corn in Egypt. Get you down thither and buy from us hence that we may live and not die." Okay, and then Joseph's 10 brethren went down to buy corn in Egypt. I don't understand why 10 of them had to go. If anyone knows the answer to that, I'd like to know afterwards, because there's clearly a lot of sons. You don't necessarily need to send 10 of them. You could send some slaves or servants or whatever if it was about heavy lifting. But he sends out 10 brethren. But of course, in verse 4, "But Benjamin, Joseph's brother, Jacob, sent not with his brethren, for he said, lest peradventure mischief befall him." So Jacob here is saying, actually, don't care about you 10, but nothing can happen to Benjamin because I trusted with Joseph and he got killed. So, you know, this sort of familial relationship was very special to him because it was these were the children that he had waited his whole life for. So he couldn't possibly afford to have anything happen to Benjamin. Okay, so let's start to summarise here. So the 10 brothers go to buy corn. Benjamin stays at home. Joseph recognises his half-brothers, but of course they don't recognise him because, well, he's not dead. And he's in a position that nobody could believe any Hebrew could be in. You know, he's the number two guy in Egypt. He's the guy in charge of giving out all the food. I'm sure he's got a beard, you know. He's probably maybe got an earring or something in the way of the Egyptians. Maybe he's got one of those crazy headdress things on. So they didn't recognise him. He gives them supplies of grain, it gets a bit interesting now because they go back, but they run out of more grain, so they come back again, and he wants to see Benjamin. That's all he wants. He wants to see Benjamin. So he says, "Okay, if you come back with Benjamin, I'll give you more grain." But he holds Simeon. I've written here as surety. He wasn't a hostage as such, but he was in jail. You know, so he was held as surety so that if they didn't come back, then the bad things were going to happen to Simeon. And what's interesting, verse 21, And they said one to another, "We are verily guilty concerning our brother, in that we saw the anguish of his soul when he besought us, and we would not hear. Therefore is this distress come upon us?" And Reuben answered them, saying, "Spake I not unto you, saying, do not sin against the child, and you would not hear?" It's like, wasn't my fault. "Therefore, behold, his blood is required." And in verse 23, "And they knew not that Joseph understood them, because he spoke unto them by an interpreter." So it's one of those great moments where you can't tell what languages a person can speak by looking at them. You might be able to guess, but you can't tell for sure. And so he's just soaking all of this in, and it's fair to say he's enjoying the moment. And he knew exactly what they were planning, what they were thinking, and so he started to plot accordingly. What's interesting, though, again, if we compare Joseph and Jesus, in verse 8 of chapter 42, "And Joseph knew his brethren, but they knew not him." If we go to John chapter 14 and verse 9, John 14 and verse 9, "Jesus said unto him, Have I been so long time with you, and yet thou hast not known me, Philip? He that has seen me has seen the Father, and how sayest thou then, Show us the Father?" So Jesus had this same experience that his disciples, who he'd spent all this time with, didn't recognise him. So just another one of those little things. Okay, Genesis 43. Okay, I'll just summarise this because we really are out of time already. In Genesis 43, the famine gets worse, so the brothers are forced to go back to Egypt with Benjamin. Now, they didn't want to. They didn't actually care less about Simeon being left behind, but they ran out of food. So they had to go back. And so realising that they hadn't actually gone back to pick up their deposit, this time they were told to take gifts of resin, honey, spices and almonds. which they did. Joseph entertains the brothers to a meal at his private residence, which, of course, not everybody that comes for food, they don't get that experience. And they still didn't twig. They were astonished when Joseph sat them down in their age order, so from oldest to youngest. You know, how could any prime minister of Egypt know that? That's a lot of research there. But they didn't. They still didn't catch on. In Genesis 44, Joseph, still tricking, he sends the brothers back home with more grain. But as they leave, he puts a silver cup, his silver cup, in Benjamin's sack. So once you read this, you know how it's going to end up. And just in case there's any doubt, he tells his chief guy to make sure he catches them up and searches for the cup. So it's like some sort of bogus customs experience going on here. And the penalty is that the person who is found with this possession has to become a slave of the Egyptian whose property it was. So, of course, things are getting messy. That Benjamin's found with this cup. The one thing they promised Dad was there's no way any harm's going to come to Benjamin. And, of course, Benjamin's now in trouble. So Reuben had promised to kill himself if bad things happened. It's all getting ugly. It's all getting ugly. But in Genesis 45, Joseph, who's, you know, really the guy in Egypt now, he can't control himself any longer. He has to break character and tell them who he is. So it's 21 years after he was sold into slavery. He lets them know that it's Joseph. He forgives them. And more importantly, he explains that all of this that's happened to him and them is God's plan. And it's true that it was, because if he hadn't been put into the hole, if he hadn't been sold into slavery, if that whole thing hadn't taken place, the Egyptians would have been subject to the same famine as everybody else. There would have been no food. Everyone would have died. That would have been unfortunate. Or, of course, God would have come up with another plan, or that was always his strategy. But in terms of this, sends the children back to Canaan. He wants to meet with his father Jacob, or his Israel by this time, and he tells them there's still five more years of famine, so don't go shirking off and thinking you can get out of it. You know, this is happy for today, but really five bad more years. So there's this reconciliation that's taken place, and in terms of the Jesus Joseph Jesus story. If we look at Genesis 45 and verse 3, it says, "And Joseph said unto his brethren, I am Joseph, does my father yet live? And his brethren could not answer him, for they were troubled at his presence, as you would be. And Joseph said unto his brethren, come near to me, I pray you. And they came near, and he said, I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt. Now, therefore, be not grieved nor angry with yourselves that you sold me hither, for God did send me before you to preserve life." So that's the story there. "For these 2 years has the famine been in the land, and there are yet five more years." And verse 7, "And God sent me before you to preserve your posterity in the earth, and to save your lives by a great deliverance." Now, this is important, because Abraham and subsequently Jacob Israel have been given these amazing promises, and how they were going to be great nations and a multitude of people, and they're all going to die. So, you know, how could you make sense of this? And this is where this thread that the Lord had placed, you know, Joseph was single-handedly responsible in that sense for God's plan and purpose at that time. That this great multitude of nations that were going to spring forth, all because of Joseph being put in a hole. You never would have picked it up. And certainly they didn't do it intentionally. So God sent me before you to preserve life. And in Romans chapter 11, it says, "And so all Israel shall be saved, as is written, there shall come out of Zion the deliverer, and shall turn away ungodliness from Jacob." So, you know, this is literal Jacob, literal Israel that this is referring to, but also, you know, the spiritual Israel, the promise that was applying there. So bad things had to happen to Joseph, but he had to reconcile with his brothers because that was what God had wanted to do. We go on in chapter 46. Israel, or Jacob, sets out from Hebron with 70 members of his family. So that's quite a lot of road trip. But that's what's going to happen. There's nothing for them where they were. He stops at Beersheba and God appears to him. And if we have a look in verse 4 of chapter 46, in fact, verse 3, and he said, I am God, the God of thy father. Fear not to go down into Egypt, for I will there make of thee a great nation. I will go down with thee into Egypt, and I will also surely bring thee up again, and Joseph shall put his hand upon thine eyes. Jacob rose up from Beersheba, and the sons of Israel carried Jacob, their father, and their little ones, and their wives in the wagons which Pharaoh had sent to carry him. Okay, so there's the promise. You know, I am God, fear not to go down to Egypt, for I will make of thee a great nation. So Joseph catches up with his father. The Pharaoh gives Jacob and his family fertile pasture land because looking after cattle was not really an Egyptian thing, but Jacob and his family had always been shepherds and, you know, grazed on the plains and that sort of thing. So what happens in Genesis 47? The famine continues. Joseph says to the people, if you want more seed, if you want food, you've got to give me your cattle. So they do that. Later in chapter 47, Joseph's got all the livestock, he's got all the land. So then what happens if we go to verse 15 of chapter 47? Sorry, I'm racing so much, but I realise we're already well past time. In verse 13 of chapter 47, and there was no bread in all the land, for the famine was very sore, so that the land of Egypt and all the land of Canaan fainted by reason of the famine. And Joseph gathered up all the money that was found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan for the corn, which they bought, and Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house. So Pharaoh's doing very well. He's making money out of a famine, but he's still providing a way for his people to, survive. Okay. Down in verse 18, so they've sold off all their cattle. In verse 18, when that year was ended, they came unto him the second year and said unto him, we will not hide it from my lord how that our money is spent. My lord also has our herds of cattle. There is not aught left in the sight of my lord but our bodies and our lands. So this is what happens. They put aside the 20%. They were going to run out of food. They've run out of food, almost completely. They've got rid of all their cattle. All they have left is themselves and their land. So Joseph, being the practical sort of guy that he is, in verse 20, and Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh. For the Egyptians sold every man his field because the famine prevailed over them, so the land became Pharaoh's. So things are not going so well there. So they've sold everything they have. All they have now is a debt, basically, that they've got to buy seed and plant seed and work the land for Pharaoh. But they do get to, in verse 24, and it shall come to pass in the increase that you shall give the fifth part unto Pharaoh, and four parts shall be your own, for seed of the field and for your food and for them of your households and for food for your little ones. And they said, thou hast saved our lives, let us find grace in the sight of my Lord, and we will be Pharaoh's servants. And that's what they were. They were basically now a nation of servants. Joseph was still in charge. The Israelites were still actually blessed. They had the cattle. They were looking after the cattle. They were in the fertile fields. So the Egyptians were being brought down. The Hebrews were being brought up. And it was God's plan and purpose. And we know that doesn't end up so well later on with Moses and the whole leaving Egypt. But at that time, if you wonder why the Egyptians didn't want Israelites didn't want to leave Egypt, they actually had it pretty good compared to what they had had. And so the leeks and the cucumbers and the garlics, it starts to make some sense. In Genesis 48, Jacob falls ill, and knowing that he'll die, He tells Joseph of his dream and how God's made a covenant with him, promising to bless his descendants. So then you have the story of Ephraim and Manasseh and the firstborn and the crossing of the arms and the sneakiness that goes on there. But Ephraim is to be the greater people, no matter what Joseph thinks. In chapter 49, Jacob blesses his 12 sons and before he dies, asks to be taken back to Canaan. In chapter 50, Jacob's body is embalmed in the manner of Egyptian royalty. Joseph's given permission to bury his father in Canaan. And Jacob is finally buried in a place called the cave of Machpelah, beside the remains of Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Rebekah, and Jacob's first wife Leah. What's interesting is that's a place. I didn't know this. This is still a well-known place. It's obviously got big modern construction over the top of it, but it's a place that you can go and visit. You probably can't go down to the exciting parts where the bones are, but it's a very, very holy place. Now that Jacob is dead, the brothers fear in chapter 50 that Joseph will take revenge on them, but he forgave them. And again, he said that this was God's plan and it was intended to save them, not to punish them. And unlike any Hollywood story ever, Joseph lives to become an old man and literally lives happily ever after. He died at age 110. His body was embalmed and placed in a sarcophagus in Egypt. Amen.